Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You're listening to True Crime Feed. Welcome to True Crime Feed. I'm your host, Angela Ferrari, here to review the best true crime podcasts from the past decade with a teensy bit of humor, plus my top three true crime picks of the week. Today on the docket, a show from the archives I think you will really enjoy. Let's discuss the case for the two-part series all about Sheila Wysocki from the podcast Criminal, hosted by the iconic Phoebe Judge. Here's a summary from the show page. In 1984, Sheila Wysocki found herself helping the police investigate the murder of her college roommate, Angela Simoda. Detectives asked her to gather information and even sent her out to dinner with the main suspect. But the case remained unsolved. 20 years later, Sheila Wysocki decided to investigate it herself. And to take your listening experience to the next level, go to thetruecrimefeed.com and sign up for my newsletter where I curate visual aids to accompany the show. You will see photos of our hero, Sheila Wysocki, and her friend, Angela Simoda, plus other important figures in Sheila's investigations. Here we have another stellar two-parter to explore from Criminal, delivered in the sweet, soothing vocal stylings of Phoebe Judge. A podcast about crime, stories of people who've done wrong, been wronged, or gotten caught somewhere in the middle. I'm Angela Ferrari, pretending to be Phoebe Judge, and this is my tribute to Criminal. Ugh, 1,000 apologies to Phoebe Judge, but I can't help it. I am such a fangirl, and this is such a cool one today because we get two unique cases in one episode. That's right, a two-for-one special here at my True Crime Bargain Podcast Emporium. All sales are final, but I think you're going to be pleased to discover another intriguing long-form podcast series along the way. We've got a lot to uncover, so let's jump right in. We begin this story in Dallas, Texas, in the early 80s. Imagine the size of the hairdos. Sheila Wysocki was a freshman at Southern Methodist University, living in the dorms when she gets assigned a beautiful, bubbly roommate, Angela Simoda, or Angie. How remarkable that you are randomly paired to live with a stranger who can potentially turn into a lifelong friend. That was Sheila and Angie. Though they had a bit of a rocky start, the two roommates were very different. Angie was from a wealthy family and attended the exclusive girls' school at Hockaday in Dallas. Now she was working towards a double major in computer science and engineering. Sheila was from a working-class background, and she was overcoming dyslexia, just hoping to get through school. Angie liked to party and was a social butterfly, making new friends everywhere she went. Sheila was quiet, didn't drink alcohol, and at social gatherings, she liked to sit back and observe. Then, of course, there was Angie's boyfriend, Lance. She had been dating him since high school. Lance lived in Amarillo, but seemed to always be hanging around. Sheila thought he was creepy. Her instincts were right. Lance had a temper, and even once pulled a knife on Angie during a fight, slicing up her clothing. That was the final straw, and the two broke up. Now the roommates could enjoy young, carefree college life. Angie pulled Sheila out of her shell. The two would go out dancing at a private disco club called the Rio Room. And the two roomies loved cruising up and down Forest Lane, checking out boys in Angie's sweet little Toyota Supra. Back in the 80s, the Supras were super sweet. The perfect cruising car for a couple of bodacious babes. Angie didn't really need a cruise for boys, though. They flocked to her. After all, she was like one of the only female students in both the computer science and engineering departments. And it didn't hurt that she was knockout gorgeous and friendly with everybody. The nerds loved her. Angie was constantly being left flowers and notes on her totally tubular Toyota Supra windshield. She had tons of admirers, but finally one man won her heart. In Angie's sophomore year, she started dating a guy named Ben. He was a few years older and worked as a construction manager. Sheila thought he was a much better match for her friend. By this point, Angie had joined a sorority and she bought her own condo where she lived off campus. Sheila stayed behind in the dorms, but Angie and Sheila remained close. Then came the weekend of the big football match, Texas versus Oklahoma. And that same weekend, the state fair was taking place. So this second weekend of October in Dallas was bumping with folks from all over. Angie couldn't wait to go out and party. Sheila went to North Texas to have a quiet weekend at home with her mother. Maybe get a haircut. Sounds like a nice time to me, Sheila. In fact, Sheila had just gotten back home from her haircut when she got the call from Angie's sorority sister that her friend was dead. And Sheila learned the gruesome details. On Friday, October 13th, 1984, Angie Simoda went out to the Rio Room with her friend Anita Catala and another friend named Russell Buchanan. According to witnesses, Angie was being Angie, a social butterfly, dancing, flirting, making friends, having a blast. Then at 1 a.m., Angie drove her two friends home, and that was the last time anyone saw her alive. Except for her boyfriend, Ben McCall. Apparently, after she dropped off Anita and Russell, Angie drove the 30-minute drive to Ben's house just to talk to him for a few minutes, then drove right back home. Ben goes on to claim that shortly after 2 a.m., he got a phone call, and it was Angie. She was acting strange, saying that there was a man inside her condo because he had asked to use the bathroom and borrow the phone. Then the call cut out. Ben tried calling Angie back, but no answer. So he got in his truck and raced towards Angie's condo. Even though this took place before cell phones, Ben had a portable phone in his truck that he used on construction sites, so he was able to place a call to 911 while en route. Officers responded and discovered a horrific scene. Angie's body was laying on her bed, covered with blood. She had been sexually assaulted and fatally stabbed 18 times. She was only 20 years old. Officers immediately interviewed Ben McCall, the boyfriend who had placed the 911 call. They found his behavior odd. His demeanor was strangely calm, and when they told him Angie was dead, he didn't immediately ask how she died. And they only had Ben's word that Angie stopped by for a quick visit after she dropped off her friends. And no record of her calling his house at 2 a.m. because local calls were not recorded at that time. And they also couldn't track where he placed the 911 call from. They only had Ben's word to go on. Sheila couldn't believe Ben would ever hurt Angie. She suggested to the authorities that they look into her ex-boyfriend Lance. After all, he had pulled a knife on Angie once before. Then, of course, that guy Russell, who went out dancing with her that night at the Rio Room. Angie and Russell always said they were just friends. Other witnesses claimed they were acting kind of flirty that night. Investigators dug deeper into all possible suspects. This was pre-DNA testing, but they could tell by the semen left behind in Angie's body that the killer was a non-secretor, which was rare. 80% of the population are secretors, meaning antigens present in their blood can also be detected in other bodily fluids like saliva or semen. And my apologies in advance, but I'm gonna have to keep repeating that disgusting word, secretor. Ugh, Ben was a secretor. And after searching his truck and examining his clothing, they found no physical evidence connecting him to Angie's murder. Lance was also a gross secretor. His alibi checked out too. He was at home in Amarillo, Texas the night of Angie's murder. As for Russell, he was a non-secretor, and his alibi was shaky. He was at home alone in bed after Angie dropped him off. Although they later found out he left town for 24 hours the day after her murder. Police continued to question Russell, but they weren't getting anywhere. So they asked Angie's friend Sheila to have dinner with Russell and see if she could shake anything loose from this non-secretor. Wow, 1980s Dallas cops, great idea. You couldn't get anywhere with the dude, so you sent in a 21-year-old girl out to dinner with someone you suspected of murder. Without protection, not even a police tail or backup. Plus, Russell drove Sheila to and from the restaurant. Russell stuck to that same story with Sheila too, but the police had Sheila convinced that this was Angie's killer. After all, Russell failed a polygraph examination, and now he's lawyered up and gone completely silent. And a short time later, Russell left the country. So even though the cops and Sheila Wasaki were convinced Russell Buchanan was Angie's killer, there was nothing more they could do at this point. For the next 20 years, Sheila went about her life. She got married and had kids, but at every milestone, she thought about Angie. Enraged that her killer Russell was still out there. Then one evening, Sheila was sitting in bed trying to stay awake so she could get through her Bible study homework when her friend Angie came to her. She was probably in some sort of dream state, but to Sheila, it felt so real, like her friend was standing right there with her in the room. And then Angie spoke.
It's time.
Sheila was wide awake now. She called the Dallas PD and asked if there had been any updates in the murder investigation of Angela Simoda. Sheila was told a definitive no. No one had looked into that case in over 20 years. The police had much more pressing cases to work on now and didn't have the manpower or resources to reopen that cold case. But Sheila wouldn't take no for an answer. She called constantly over the next few years. It was a lot easier now with cell phones. Sheila called the Dallas PD and various agencies over 700 times, hoping someone would help her look into the file. Then Sheila had an idea. She should become a licensed private investigator. Before this story, I knew very little about all the fringe benefits available to licensed PIs. I thought the big appeal was getting to wear those style and tweed deerstalker hats and the occasional fake mustache. But it turns out there's even more sweet perks to the gig. Licensed private investigators have access to criminal databases that are not available to the public. So that would be Sheila Wysocki's in. She job shadowed another PI who sponsored her, and Sheila spent the next few years studying for her exam. Her young son even helped her with flashcards.
All right, Mom, what are the three most effective steps to catch a cheating spouse red-handed?
I know this one. Oh yeah, a comprehensive background investigation followed by physical surveillance and lastly, honey trapping.
Nailed it!
After all of her hard work, Sheila passed her exam. And now it was time to open Angie's file. At this point, another 5 years had gone by since Sheila started this mission. She also got word that Russell Buchanan had moved back to the area and was now working as a successful architect.
Not for long,
Sheila thought. She finally got connected to someone at the Dallas PD to help her look into this cold case, a detective named Linda Crum. Linda told Sheila they still had evidence from Angie's crime scene, including the semen and fingernail scrapings. Items that could easily be tested for DNA. This was exactly what she needed to take down Russell Buchanan once and for all. The DNA results came back. They found their match. And guess who it was? Donald Bess.
What? Who the f*** is Donald Bess?
Sheila had never heard this name before, but blood, semen, and nail scrapings from Angie's crime scene all tested positive for DNA from Donald Bess. Back in 1984, Bess was 36 years old, wandering around the Dallas area on parole after serving time for sexual assault and kidnapping charges. He must have knocked on Angie's door and asked to use the phone. And this being the 1980s and Angie being Angie, she kindly let him in, opening the door to her killer. All this time, over 25 years, Sheila had always believed what the original cops told her, that Russell Buchanan was the man who killed her friend Angie. She wanted him convicted and sent to death row. But Russell had been telling the truth the whole time. If he hadn't gotten a lawyer, he would probably be sitting in jail right now, wrongfully convicted for Angie's murder. Sheila still feels guilty to this day for harboring those thoughts about Russell. Thankfully, the physical evidence had been preserved all these years and finally led them to the true killer. In 2010, Donald Bess went on trial for Angela Samota's murder. At that time, he was also currently serving time for another rape conviction. And yet, his defense team did their best to paint Angie as a promiscuous party girl who consensually had sex with Donald Bess. The defense lawyer even brought up what Angie was wearing that night. A revealing outfit, which basically meant she was asking for it. And again, let me remind you, this trial took place in 2010 and not the 1800s. Despite the defense team doing their best to smear Angie's character, Donald Bess was convicted. During his sentencing, more women came forward, testifying that they too had been sexually assaulted by Donald Bess. He was sentenced to death, but while he was awaiting his execution on death row, he died from a heart attack in prison in 2022. It was over, though. Sheila finally had resolution for her friend Angie. All those phone calls, all that studying and work it took to get her PI license, Angie's case was the only one she cared about. So it was time for her to go back to her normal life now. Except, word had gotten out about Angie Samota and how her best friend Sheila Wysocki worked to get her case a second look and found resolution after 25 years. There were so many others out there, desperate to find answers to what happened to their own loved ones. Sheila started getting calls, parents and families begging her for help. She had to say no to most of them, but she couldn't say no to all. There was one case in particular she felt compelled to take on as a licensed private investigator. The mysterious case of Lauren Agee. Phoebe Judge and the criminal team dedicate a full episode shadowing Sheila as she conducts her investigation into Lauren Agee's case. In that episode, we get a realistic overview of what life is like as a private investigator, including the pretty hardcore cybersecurity measures Sheila undergoes to keep her findings confidential.
That part had me feeling pretty cyber insecure.
And now I'm really paranoid someone's gonna hack my Mac and steal all my cool podcast sound effects. And while we're on the topic of dope podcasts, Sheila Wysocki launched her own podcast called Without Warning. Season 1 is entirely dedicated to the Lauren Agee case. If you are looking for definitive answers fast, Without Warning might not be for you. But if you really want to know what it's like to be a PI working a case and get into all those nitty-gritty details, crowdsourcing info, and having that real-time ride-along experience, you will love this show, especially season 1. Lauren's mother, Sherry Smith, was desperate for answers after investigators originally ruled her daughter's death an accident. Sheila worked this case with two other PIs, both named Michael. So let me give you a quick overview of Lauren Agee's story.
In July 2015, 21-year-old Lauren Agee was on summer break from college where she was studying criminal science. Lauren and her longtime friend, Hannah Palmer, attended Wakefest at Center Hill Lake in Tennessee. It's kind of a funky lake, originally created in the 1940s for electricity by damming up a section of the Canny Fork River. So Center Hill Lake has all these winding, twisting curves to it, plus waterfalls and steep cliffs. It's a popular spot for fishing, camping, and of course, extreme water sports. Wakefest is a huge event on the lake, attracting 2,000 plus spectators to watch the wakeboarding competitions over the course of a 3-day weekend. On Friday, July 24th, 2015, Lauren and Hannah met up with a guy named Aaron Lilly, who Hannah was romantically involved with, and his friend Chris Stout. They attended lakeside parties and watched events during the day, and then set up camp for the night. They had to take a canoe to the opposite shore across from Patesford Marina to get to their campsite, which was pitched way up on a steep cliff overlooking the lake, a 90-foot straight drop to the water. The group pitched a tent and a hammock. Yes, you heard me. A hammock on the side of a cliff. That's a no for me, dog. The only hammock I'm trying to get into is for bananas. But we're dealing with youths in their early 20s who are into extreme water sports, so I guess this is the norm for them. Everything went smooth the first night, and then the next day the group continued to enjoy the festivities. Lauren was seen partying at a place called Fish Lips, and that's lips spelled with a Z. Then she returned back to the campsite with Hannah, Aaron, and Chris. According to the rest of her camping party, everyone had been drinking that night, and Hannah Palmer and Aaron Lilly slept in the tent, and Chris Stout and Lauren Agee slept in the hammock together. The next morning, Lauren was gone. Her phone, keys, shoes, and all of her clothes were still at the campsite. But her friends didn't seem alarmed by this. They went about partying and enjoying the Sunday wake festivities. In fact, at one point during that same afternoon while Lauren was still missing, Chris Stout posted a photo from the fest with the caption, "Best weekend ever." Then around 4:30, two anglers are fishing in a quiet cove away from the Wakefest revelry when they spotted the body of a dead woman floating in the water. They called first responders who retrieved the body and worked to identify her, which wasn't easy because the three friends she had been camping with never reported her missing. Eventually, the police are able to deduce that the dead woman in the water was 21-year-old Lauren Agee. Her friends chalked it up to a tragic drunken accident, and the MEs collect evidence but generally agree with that interpretation. Case closed. So now, Lauren's mother, Sherry Smith, has to go through the heart-wrenching ordeal of burying her daughter. And she finds it very strange that the three people who were all with her the night that she died, including her good friend Hannah Palmer, did not attend Lauren's funeral. And there were other details that felt off to Sherry as well. So despite the police deducing this was an open and shut case, Sherry Smith decided to hire private investigators to take a closer look. That's when Sheila and the Mike stepped in, and they agreed this whole accident narrative was fishier than fish lips spelled with a Z. First off, they learned that the cove where Lauren was found was in the opposite direction of the current. And again, this was a man-made lake on a flooded river with a consistent current. Plus, the two responding officers on the scene first, they were reserve officers from White County, Sergeant Chris Yarchuk and Deputy Ryan Melanson. They thought this scene looked like foul play from the get-go, and the strange stories coming from the other three present at the campsite that night, that only made things more suspicious. like when Chris Stout claimed he and Lauren AG were sleeping next to each other in the hammock all night, and at some point, Lauren just must have gotten up in the middle of the night and accidentally stumbled off the side of a cliff while he was fast asleep. I'm sorry, but unless this is some sort of miracle Tempur-Pedic shock-absorbent swing-resistant hammock, you're gonna be waking up and notice when someone hops out of that thing. There's no such thing as subtly sneaking out of a hammock. And even more sinister, while Officer Melanson was transporting Chris Stout and Aaron Lilly back to the marina via pontoon boat, the officer noticed Chris Stout staring at his sidearm. So Melanson asks,
"What are you thinking over there?"
And Stout replied,
"I'm thinking about how I'm gonna get that gun off your hip and get off this boat."
Melanson shot back,
"That's not gonna happen."
But about 10 minutes later, Christopher Stout repeated that eerie remark again. But even though Officers Yarchuk and Melanson were the first to respond and immediately suspected foul play, this was not their jurisdiction. So they had to hand all of their info over to the DeKalb County Police. The White County officers were later appalled that the DeKalb Police ruled this an accident, ignoring so many glaring signs of foul play. Their hands are tied until Sheila and the Mikes come in. The team tested out the story of an accidental fall by taking a dummy the same height and weight and tried repeated attempts to push it down the cliff into the water. They repeated this experiment over 50 times. Every single time, the dummy got caught on branches on the way down and never made it into the lake. So it seemed very unlikely that this was an accidental trip and fall into the water. Here's where things get even murkier. Sheila and the Mikes take another look at the autopsy report and get a second opinion from a forensic pathologist. These findings were rage-inducingly insufficient. The original examiners never did a rape kit, even though there was a photograph showing a clear bite mark on one of Lauren's breasts, and her larynx had been crushed, which is far more consistent with being choked versus falling. It was also telling what was absent from Lauren's ME report. There was no water found in her lungs. It is possible that you can dry drown and not get water in your lungs, but it is quite rare. There was also a lack of scratches and bruising present, inconsistent with falling down a cliff. Usually on the way down, a body would hit rock and brush, leaving telltale marks on the skin. Officer Yarchuk was quick to point out a strange mark on Lauren's abdomen, the shape of a perfect triangle. His theory was that Lauren was killed and her body was draped over the bow of a canoe, which has that exact same shape. He suggests someone in that camping party killed Lauren, had access to that canoe, and transported her to the cove and dumped her body. And if that body had been draped over the front of the canoe during the transport, the blood pooling post-mortem could have left a triangle-shaped mark, but the DeKalb County Police never tested the canoe. The only thing to corroborate the drunken accident story was that Lauren's BA level was 1.6, twice the legal limit, the equivalent of 3 drinks in 2 hours for a woman weighing 120 pounds. Though witnesses who were at the Fish Lips bar with Lauren that night said she didn't appear to be inebriated, just her usual happy, high-spirited self. Though one friend distinctly remembers Chris Stout aggressively hitting on Lauren. On her podcast, Without Warning, you hear more about Sheila's investigation into Hannah Palmer, Aaron Lilly, and Chris Stout. But Sheila Wysocki knows, based on her friend Angie's case, that someone may look culpable, but just because they were in proximity with a victim doesn't mean they killed her. It's really fascinating to hear the techniques that Sheila uses to build trust and get people talking. Some of the techniques maybe cross the line a little to me, but again, we're dealing with a world of private investigation, so a whole lot of gray area. Criminal convictions are never a guarantee, but PIs can still be helpful to get families answers. After Sheila and the Mikes complete their investigation, in 2017, Lauren's mother, Sherry, filed a $10 million wrongful death case against Aaron, Chris, and Hannah. The DeKalb County Court originally ruled to dismiss Hannah Palmer and her very relevant testimony, as well as DeKalb County officers' testimony and key pieces of evidence from the scene. But that decision was overruled by an appellate court. Sherry ended up dropping the civil lawsuit and is hoping for an eventual jury trial. And like I said, there is so much more to this story. You can learn all about it on season one of Without Warning with private investigator Sheila Wysocki, the woman who refused to let her best friend's murder go unsolved, who went from housewife and mother to one of the most highly sought after PIs in the country. She stopped waiting and hoping for resolution to come, and instead Sheila took the actions to make things happen. Something every single one of us is capable of. You didn't know this was going to turn into an inspirational Mel Robbins-style podcast, did ya? Remember, you're just one decision away from a completely different life. But please keep all activities on the up and up, because you don't want to be on Sheila Wysocki's bad side. Or even worse, have Phoebe judge you on her next episode of Criminal. I'd love to hear your thoughts about today's show, especially if you are a private investigator. Even though PIs aren't legally required to identify themselves and can use any form of deception and trickery to conceal their mission. Which means, this whole time, I could be a secret PI investigating your podcast listening habits. I already know just by listening to this, you've got some weird taste. So let me know your thoughts on today's True Crime Feed Deluxe double feature. You can email me directly at Angela@thetruecrimefeed.com or join the True Crime Feed Facebook discussion group. Keep an open mind and be kind to fellow True Crime Feed friends. Stay tuned till after the break to hear my top three podcast power ranking of the week. Hey you. I'm so glad we found each other and get to share our special love for true crime podcasts. I don't ever want you to miss out on a wild story. That would be a crime in itself. So be sure to hit that follow or subscribe button on your podcast app and share your favorite episode with a friend so the next time you see each other, you can splurge about your latest true crime obsession. Thanks for spreading the word, and now back to the show. And we're back. This is another one of those weeks we are in a bull market when it comes to podcasts. There are so many great ones out right now, I don't even have a miss. Instead, I have four shows currently trending that I think are worth a listen. I present to you this week's podcast power ranking.
4, 3, 2, 1.
At the number four spot, we have Murder in the Hollywood Hills. Here's a synopsis from the show page. Christy Johnson was shopping at a mall in Los Angeles when a man invited her to a photo shoot for the next Bond film. That afternoon, the 21-year-old got into her little white sports car and drove to the shoot location up in the Hollywood Hills. She was never seen alive again. In Dateline's latest podcast, Keith Morrison takes us to the city of dreams for the story of a smooth-talking predator who lured young women into a nightmare with promises of fame and fortune. First episode was perfectly fine, nothing special, but the entire second episode, I was incredulous. The episode title is Man at the Mall, but it should have been titled, Wait, What? Really? So far, so decent with Murder in the Hollywood Hills. At the number three spot, we have Three. Kind of fitting. Here's a summary from the show page. After midnight on July 6, 2012, three teenage girls walked into the thick Appalachian woods somewhere along the Mason-Dixon County line. Hours later, under the glow of a nearly full moon, only two walked out. What happened to Skylar Neese has become Gothic American lore, the odd girl out in a vicious teenage triangle. But in the 10 years since that fateful night, beneath the West Virginia stars, a fuller portrait of what happened has emerged. I don't know exactly how I feel about this one. All I know is I can't stop listening. Most crimes usually feel completely senseless, but this one is exceptionally mystifying and tragic. The whole time, I've been clamoring for some sort of explanation to help make sense, and I was hoping we'd finally get that with episode 8 titled Why, Why? So in this episode, we are 10 years post-trial, and we finally hear from Rachel during her parole hearing, explaining her mindset at the time. Rachel gives a very detailed explanation, but I soon realized that nothing she said helped give me any clarity. And yet, I still liked the fact that this podcast goes there, continues to follow the aftermath and search for answers. We still have 2 more episodes remaining. I have no idea how they're going to close the series out, but I continue to be captivated by the podcast 3. At the number 2 spot, we have Hello, John Doe. Here's a reminder from the show page. At age 45, Steve Patterson made a shocking online discovery, his own missing persons page. Desperate to uncover why he had been included on that list, Steve called Todd Matthews, a missing persons investigator in search of answers. Together, Todd and Steve discover a sordid family past that includes long-lost relatives, kidnappings, and murders. Hello, John Doe is a winding, poignant tale that explores what it means to be lost and found. I feel like every question you have and every perspective you want to hear from, you get on this show. This is one of the heaviest stories I've heard in a long time, but my hope is that it's bringing everyone involved to a better place, shining sunlight after a lifetime of dark, lurking questions. I continue to be so grateful for Todd Matthews and his warm, kind voice guiding us through Hello, John Doe. And at the number 1 spot, we have Serial Season 4. Here's a rundown from the show page. Serial returns with a history of Guantanamo told by people who lived through key moments in Guantanamo's evolution, who know things that the rest of us don't about what it's like to be caught inside an improvised justice system. Sup, Sarah Koenig. It's been a while, and I know we've had our differences in the past, but I gotta tell you, your audio sounds good, girl. Yes, for sure, this is a weighty subject, but I wasn't prepared for how much debauchery was happening at Gitmo. An amazing first episode, and I am very intrigued by the coming up on teaser for Serial Season 4. Find out next week if Serial Season 4 will hang on to that number 1 spot as the series continues, or if another show will swoop in and take its place. Let me know what trending shows are in your top 4, and I'll meet you back here next week to dust off another superb true crime show from the archive for your next feeding fix. That's all for today's True Crime Feed. Don't forget to sign up for my weekly newsletter where I post links to my top 3, sometimes 4, favorite shows of the week and bring you fabulous visual aids for every episode. Be sure to follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook to join the conversation, especially Instagram where I'm making my own original dank memes for every episode. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and tell your fellow partners in crime to tune in to True Crime Feed. It's a huge help to grow the show and it means the world to me, so thanks for riding along and allowing me to be your audio accomplice. Join me next week for another feeding.
When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming? Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.